nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
We have Dr. Peter Kazarinoff, and if you've been to the sessions before, you've seen Peter a couple of times earlier, and he's a faculty in engineering at Portland Community College. So we went all the way across the country to Portland for Peter, and Peter is here now. And joining us later on for a demonstration, we have Grant Shao from Stanford University, and he's a lab operations engineer, and he'll be doing a demo of the confocal microscopy from Stanford. Today's topic will be wave particle interaction characterization, and specifically we will be talking about confocal microscopy.
So I'm Peter Kazarinoff, and thank you for having me, and let me talk about confocal microscopy. And I'm going to talk about confocal microscopy in terms of technician training at two-year community colleges. If you've got any questions while we go through, please let me know either in the chat or just over the microphone. And I'm excited to see what Grant's going to show us, so I'm going to try to be fairly brief here. So I'm going to talk about confocal microscopy for technicians. Fatma's presentation was in confocal microscopy for research. And I'm going to talk about how we taught technicians to use confocal microscopes. So confocal microscopes don't resolve down to the nanometer size scale like transmission electron microscopes or scanning electron microscopes. So why would we teach technicians that go work in the nanotechnology industry confocal microscopy? Why don't we just teach them SEM, TEM, AFM type methods? And the answer that we found up in Seattle, as well as here in Portland, is that in a lot of medical imaging centers at hospitals, as well as biological imaging centers, they're going to have both scanning electron microscopes and transmission electron microscopes that we were training our technicians to use. But those same facilities also often have laser scanning confocal microscopes. And if a student can use an SEM or a TEM to level them up to use a confocal microscope, it requires some additional training, but there are a lot of concepts that are in common with SEMs and AFMs. So here in Portland, for instance, at Oregon Health Sciences University, their imaging center has SEMs and TEMs, but also has a lot of state-of-the-art laser scanning confocal microscopes. And so if we give technicians that confocal training, they've got one extra thing on their resume that will set them apart from other candidates who want to work in those microscopy facilities. One other reason that we thought it was important is that getting underrepresented groups into technician training has been particularly difficult. And one of the groups that we were trying to get greater enrollment in is women. And what we saw in the Seattle region and at our college is that women were better represented in the biology classes and the art classes compared to our technician training classes. And so if we could bring in this kind of biology angle into nanotechnology, then maybe we could also bring in more women into the technician training program. So that was the reason that we wanted to use laser scanning microscopy in our training, even though it isn't really a nanotechnology characterization method, because you are limited to the diffraction of light rather than using electrons to image the sample in the case of SEM and TEMs. So what did we train these technicians to do with confocals? Well, the sample preparation for confocal microscopy is quite different than it is for SEMs or TEMs. And we had to instruct students on how to prepare slides, how to use cover slips, how to use fixatives, and how to use sample dishes. We also needed to teach students how to image the samples, how to change the pinhole depth, how to change the level level that they were taking the slice at, how to use different lasers to illuminate different samples, and as well as how to save those images and keep those images in a shared location that's often used in microscopy facilities. We also needed to instruct the students on how to replenish consumables, things like slides, cover slips, lens cleaner, stuff like that. How to do basic microscope maintenance, including cleaning off the lenses, including doing any adjustment of the sample stages, and then also basic microscope repair. If something went wrong with a microscope, we want to train technicians to be able to fix those as best we can. There's some repairs that definitely technicians from the companies that make the microscopes need to come out and do. But sometimes there's some fairly simple repairs that if a technician could do in-house, that would save the microscopy facility quite a bit of money. So here's an example of our training laser scanning confocal microscope in our nanotechnology lab. And on the left-hand image, you can see yellow boxes with some of the consumables that the technicians need to make sure were always available. And in the front, you see these black sample holders. And these sample holders could hold different sample types, like sample dishes, sort of like little petri dishes with glass cover slips at the bottom, or microscope slides, or larger square sample boxes. And we instructed students on how to correctly mount and fix those samples. In the right-hand image, what you can see is the inside of the laser scanning confocal microscope. Because laser scanning confocal microscopes are collecting fluorescent light, light which is emitted from the sample after the sample is illuminated by the lasers, the quantity of that light is pretty low. So you need a completely dark environment in order to get the best signal-to-noise ratio out of the confocal. So in our confocal, you had to close down the hood while you were doing the imaging in order to prevent any stray light from coming into the detector. You can also see here in the right-hand image that as the laser scanning confocal microscope scans across the sample, the scanning in the X and Y directions in our microscope was done by moving the sample stage. But the scanning in the Z direction, the height direction, that was done with the lens assembly. Another way that we wanted to increase student involvement in nanotechnician training was to partner with art classes at our community college. As I mentioned before, biology and art classes had a greater percentage of women in them compared to our technician training program. So we partnered with one of the art classes on campus and gave an exhibit of laser scanning confocal microscope images along with student sculptures and student prints. And we hope that that would increase our enrollment when art students saw the amazing images that we could create with the laser scanning confocal microscope. So on the left-hand side, you can see the art exhibit. And on the right-hand side, you can see examples of student-collected images during our technician training program that were collected with the laser scanning confocal microscope. So next, what I'm going to show is basically showing off the students' work. These technician students were able to make some amazing laser scanning confocal images and also make images that were in applications that were important to them personally. So next, I'm going to show a couple of 2D images and then move on to talking about some 3D images and how those were collected. So the a lot of these samples fluoresce on their own without dyes being added to them. Fatma was talking about using specific dyes to show fluorescence in the sample, but a lot of naturally occurring cells will fluoresce on their own. And one of the chemicals that will fluoresce on its own is chlorophyll. Chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B have slightly different excitation wavelengths and slightly different emission wavelengths. But you can image any cells that have chlorophyll in them with a laser scanning confocal microscope without adding any dye. Quantum dots are also used as a type of dye in laser scanning confocal microscopes. And you can change the emission wavelength that comes out of these quantum dots by changing basically the size of the quantum dot, or by potentially changing the material that the quantum dot is made out of. And by putting certain organic molecules on the surface of the quantum dot, you can have quantum dot-based dyes target different types, different parts of the cell, like the nucleus, the mitochondria, or the cell membrane. So these are images of algae that one of the students collected from a pond that was near their house that had ducks in it. And here we can see the two different types of chlorophyll and the natural fluorescence that comes out of those types of chlorophyll. And you can see in the scale bar that the image on the right-hand side is a zoomed-in version compared to the image on the left-hand side. This is an example of a student image of pine tree pollen. One of the students had a pine tree at his house. We've got a lot of pine and fir trees in the Pacific Northwest. And pine tree pollen also autofluoresces at two different wavelengths. And that's why you see both the pink color and the blue color. Those are two different detectors, which are picking up the fluorescence from the pine tree pollen. This is an example of an anther arm. It's part of a flower that a student collected. And this part of the flower also autofluoresces. And this flower part autofluoresces in three different wavelengths. So that's why we can see three different colors present in this flower image. These are examples of mites, teeny little like bug insects that a student collected. And the outside of the legs and the shells of these mites also auto fluoresced. And I think this is a good example of something that I would have never thought to stick in the confocal microscope, these little bugs. But a student found them and put them in the confocal microscope, and we were able to image them without adding any dyes. So next, I'm going to show some 3D laser scanning confocal microscope images. Fatma mentioned that we can take image slices of a sample, and using computers, we can then take those slices and assemble them together in order to make a 3D image. The way that you get those sample slices is by changing the objective lens to collect a different focal plane, and by changing the pinhole detector size, and that will change the slice thickness. So if you want to get a really good looking 3D image, you've got to use a very small pinhole size, so you get a really narrow slice. But what that does cause is you've got to image for a long time, because the total amount of light that comes into the detector is fairly low. You also generally have to use a pretty slow scanning speed across the sample, because you need to leave the laser in a location for a longer time, so you get a greater number of photons. So collecting 3D images for our technician students took a lot longer than collecting 2D images. So on the left-hand side, you can see a three-dimensional image of the pine pollen that I showed earlier. And this three-dimensional image was collected by taking a large number of vertical slices and then assembling them together in software. This is an example of a three-dimensional image of a normal tar ovary epithelium. Normal tar is a type of like mountain sheep that's in Nepal and Tibet. And dyes were added to the sample in order to show the nucleus of the cell and the cell membranes. This is an example of pumpkin pollen that a student brought into the lab from the vegetables that were growing in their garden. And you can see sort of little ripples in this three-dimensional image. And each one of those ripples is basically one of those slices in the vertical direction that has then been assembled all together in a computer. And the reason that the pumpkin pollen looks flat on the bottom is that there is a limit with our confocal microscope in the depth of height that you can scan. And this pumpkin pollen was thicker than the possible depth that the confocal microscope can scan to. So next, I'm going to show some animations of what these slices look like up through different vertical planes. So the first one I'm going to show are the mites. So here what we can see is sequential vertical planes being collected by the laser scanning confocal microscope. And then these planes have been assembled together to make a little movie. On the right-hand side, this image is one of these mites zoomed into a greater magnification. And the different colors that we can see are due to the different detector wavelengths picking up fluorescence from the laser scanning confocal microscope. These two images were generated from some pollen. On the left-hand side, this image is the sequential slices animated through time. And on the right-hand side, those sequential slices are built up together. And in software, you can create a three-dimensional object and then rotate that three-dimensional object through space. And this type of image isn't possible to collect using a regular light microscope. The advantages that the confocal has is it can slice the sample vertically into different planes. And the other advantage is that the practical resolution that you get is higher than a light microscope because the laser scans across the surface of the sample, sort of like the electron beam or the arm in an atomic force microscope or the electron beam in a scanning electron microscope.
Do you also have like temperature stage and you can change the temperature when you're looking at the images?
Yeah, in our Olympus microscope, we could also change the temperature of the stage and manage that. And we could also put many different types of samples in the stage as well. What we weren't able to ever do is image frozen samples, but within sort of like the free regular, like a couple degrees C to higher than room temperature, we could vary the temperature of the samples. I wish I could say that I did all that work, but that was all of the students, all the technician students. They collected those and they created portfolios that they could bring when they did interviews and show people who are interviewing them the images they collected and how they collected them.
So, Grant, thank you again very much for helping us today with this demonstration, confocal demonstration. Grant is now connecting from Stanford University, and is the confocal, did you say it's inside the clean room? You have the bunny suit on. That's what I would guess, right? It's inside the clean room. Yeah, so you guys are using it for a little bit of a different purpose, I guess, there. So some various different samples there. So he's going to be showing us how, like in a demo setting, a confocal can be used for imaging the samples that Grant has prepared for us. Yeah, thank you, Grant. So let's go ahead.
Brief introduction. I am at Stanford. I'm in one of the user facilities, clean rooms. And so basically we have a bunch of mainly PhD graduate students coming in and doing their research here. And so in our clean room, we're mainly nano and microfabrication, not so much biology. So the example that I'm going to show today is going to be kind of more of a micro device, so to speak. So here I have that guy. It's a QMSVKX 3D laser scanning confocal microscope. I don't really dive into the manual stuff that Peter talked about. It kind of just automates things for me. And I just teach our users how to use it. Basically, we have the stage. We could do manual focus in that way. And then you can do further fine-tuning with the lens itself. And so the lens will open. Once you have things relatively in focus, you can go ahead and just do a simple measurement. All I need to do is hit start measurement. It automatically detects roughly what height settings to use. In other words, what planes, Z planes, it should scan through, depending on the height profile of my sample. And then it basically just starts scanning until you get to see it before you cross. It's a very fast and easy tool, which is why a lot of our users like it. Because then they can get, you know, a pretty decent image, sometimes better than the normal light microscope, and not have to spend the amount of time that you typically spend with, like, an SEM.
Okay, and save this.
So this here is the analysis software. And so here we can, you know, pull up an image, take a closer look. Pretty standard, but we can also take a look at the 3D image and just manipulate it as we wish. Before I play around with this some more, I'm actually going to, you'll see kind of a tilt plane across the sample, so I can actually go ahead and correct for that. I'm just doing a bunch of clicking. But the main idea is that I'm basically selecting what my reference plane is, which is all of this cyan blue color, which happens to be my substrate surface. And then it will reference plane correction. So now that tilt has kind of gone away. Now if I look at the 3D image and if I zoom in, you kind of see my square pillar. So I think that's pretty cool. Again, we're doing it, it kind of just automates everything for me, so I don't have to do the 3D reconstruction. But this is one of the cool features that you can play. Along with that, oh, did you have something to say?
Grant, this is Peter. I've got a quick question. Is the detector picking up reflected light from the sample, or is it picking up fluoresced light from the sample?
I believe it's reflected light. This is a aluminum square pillars on top of a silicon substrate. So we're not really fluorescing.
Cool. Thank you.
And then what we can also do with this information is we can, for example, take a look at the profile. So basically, along this line, I'm taking the profile that it's scanned. to be pretty accurate. I think I designed it to be 25 micron by 25 micron squares here. So basically, I'm just measuring my dimensions. And so this is, again, it's just so much faster than using an SEF. And you can kind of get an entire picture rather than single line as opposed to a plotter, for example. That's why a lot of our micro and nanofabrication users will use it. Another quick example would be the volume and area feature here. And so basically have it select just each region, these convex regions, and it basically spits out a bunch of information from the volume in each one of these boxes, surface area, other parameters here. And so that can also be useful. Kind of depends. Sometimes, you know, you have wells instead of fillers, and so you might need to know what the volume within that well is if you're filling it up with fluid, for example. This kind of information. I'll give you one last example here, an average step height. I can select, again, my reference point. Then expand that out. Just to fill in all those small holes. And now I have an average step height between my pillars and my substrate surface. It reads roughly 200 nanometers, which sounds about right. I deposited roughly 200 nanometers. So again, just if you're looking at your sample and you want a quick measurement of what's going on.
Did you say 200 nanometers?
Yeah. So it says here 211 microns. 200 nanometers. Okay, that's pretty much it. I can dive into the more manual setting, a little bit more manual setting. There's an expert mode, is what they call it. The expert mode, I typically like using the laser setting, so rather than using an optical camera, example, setting, but just the laser. And so here, basically, I can specify on my phone what my height settings are, my height limits. Typically, you would just basically move the lens all the way up until everything's out of focus, in other words. Move the lens back down until it comes into focus, and then it goes back out of focus. You can adjust the laser intensity here, but typically I just put the software in permanent. And there's a couple other settings, but those are typically standard, and then again, you just hit start measurement. Again, it's very much a lot more automated compared to, I think, what Peter's does. So that's the rough idea of what we're using our microscope for.
Great. Yeah, it looks very cool. Thank you again. And Greg has a question, I believe. Greg, do you want to unmute yourself? Or?
Yeah, I appreciate it. On this particular piece of equipment, can you drive to specific wafer coordinates or sample coordinates? If you knew, like on an XY plane, that you had a feature that you wanted to review, could you type those that coordinates in, or do you drive to it manually?
You drive to it, you can't. So if you're looking at the stage position window here, I can't really see this map, but it does give you the XY coordinates, but you can't manually input them. I switch back over here. I'm basically using the arrows to move around. And then, but if you do want to, let's say, center on something, I can just double click on it and make sure it's centered.
Okay.
Can't just enter an XY coordinate. I think maybe because if you're looking at, you take a look at, if you look at my video here, the stage is just a, if you just put the sample on the screen, it's not a specific sample folder, so you can't necessarily center your sample to a particular XY coordinate.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
Grant, this is Peter again. For your instrument in the clean room, what's your practical XY resolution limit, and what's your practical Z limit, resolution limit?
It's a good question that I don't really have a answer for. I know what the manufacturer's specification, I think the XY limit is something like, or resolution, I think it's 25 nanometers, and then the Z resolution is 5 angstroms. But, I mean, we're in the clean room, and it's super loud, and just the acoustics makes that not right, not accurate. So, but I'm not entirely sure. Even with the acoustics, sometimes you'll even see when you take this can, you'll see the wavelength.
And one other question about sample types. Fatma and I showed biological samples that were either dyed or autofluoresced. Have you encountered samples that this imaging technique isn't good for, like a particular type of material that you try to use this microscope for, and it doesn't really work?
I would say for most applications, it'll probably work. I mean, I've seen things like rock samples, films, like gels. There is one feature on this tool, on this particular tool. I don't know if it's applicable to all people, but there is an option where if you have a relatively transparent thin film, because of how it's detecting, basically it's detecting the laser intensity at various Z heights. If you have, a thin film on top of your silicon wafer, for example, you can get a peak of laser intensity at the surface of your transparent film, as well as at the intersection or the interface between the thin film and your silicon substrate. And so with that information, theoretically, you could get the thin film thickness. And so that's a really attractive feature for us when we're looking at resist, because then we need to know the resist thickness when we go ahead and expose. But unfortunately with this, I think it just is not compatible with the resist that we have. So that's probably the one test.
And we also had a question from Abdel Ali. Again, the one that you've just shown here, these grids, is that a mask layout by any chance? Or
I patterned this with electron beam lithography. Mm-hmm. So rather than hard mask.
Yeah, so this isn't like a stamp, right? Because it had a probably...
It was directly written on the resist.
Yes.
And then I deposited aluminum on top and then did a lift up.
I see. Okay. Gotcha.
This is one of the better results that I had. Mm-hmm. And I was making this, I mean, primarily for as a demo sample, as well as a way to train people. So I kind of have a standard. And the various sizes of my squares gives me the flexibility to train people on the profilometer, on the SEM, all with just one sample. So that's kind of why I made this.
Oh, yeah. So when you are training people, so what do you say, like, when you compare the profilometer measurements and the ones that you get from here, like, when the student asks, like, which one should I rely more on in terms of the resolution?
It's hard to say. Generally, they're very close to one another, the measurements that you get. There's faults to both methods. With profilometer, I mean, you're literally dragging a stylus across your sample. And so sometimes when you pump up, there might be a little flip or something like that. similar to here. I mean, it is with light, which is, I mean, you're going to get pretty good resolution. But same thing, because we are working with much closer to nano-sized features, a lot of times the wavelength doesn't quite get there. So you kind of just have to look at your results, compare, see what makes the most sense.
Yeah, Grant, thank you very much again. So it was great to see a demonstration, a live demonstration. It was my first time, honestly, seeing one of those.